Ladies and gentlemen, today we enter a totally new situation, a new chapter in men's consciousness. The Frenchman has written a very book with a very good title and a very poor text. It's called Des Clans aux Empires, From the Clans to the Empires. Yeah, we cannot very well translate it in English with the same emphasis. It's a wonderful title, and that's exactly what we have to do today, to take the step from clannishness and primitive tribal man to the great empires, the pyramid builders of China and Egypt and the Aztecs and the Mayas in Yucatan, all over the globe. Around the 30th degree of latitude, there is to be observed a strange light in the sky, and that has given origin to all astrology, our astronomy, all pyramidal cults, all writing on stone, and to, as you have it today, on paper. How does this come about? It has taken many, many hundred years before northern men, the men from Greece and Rome, became aware of the fact that the ancient peoples were led by a sign in the sky. And even today you can read most books about the Incas or about the pharaohs or the Chinese, completely ignorant of this great distinction between the countries on the 30th degree of, around the 30th degree of latitude, and your and my situation in a climate of the so-called moderate zone. You can't see it on the 40th or 50th degree of latitude, which is our latitude here. See? That's Richmond, by and large, isn't it? Now, it is quite interesting. You are, allegedly, you are enlightened and educated and instructed. But this simple difference that men under the 30th degree of latitude see the different sky from what we see here has remained unknown. This fact was discovered for the first time in Occidental history in 1611, when a monk observed in Egypt the zodiacal light, as they call it, with an impossible name. The Egyptians and the Mayas had a much more pertinent name for it. When Alexander von Humboldt, the great explorer, whose name you know from the Humboldt River, when he traveled here in America, he came to Arizona and he saw around Santa Fe and Flagstaff, New Mexico, he saw a light which he called the pyramidal light. We see in the sky at this latitude a pyramid. The pyramid is 200 degrees wide, so it's an immense white light lying on the horizon in the first 2 hours of the morning and the last 2 hours at sunset. And the pyramid is in the sky, and that's why we have pyramids on Earth. Men, of course, imitate what he sees in the world at large. And just as the masks imitate birds and animals in the tribe, so our pyramids imitate what is visible in the sky. But since our modern high school teachers do wish to know everything from books, they never look at the sky. And to this day, you cannot find in any books the simple fact that the pyramids on Earth in Egypt are imitation of something you can see. And this, I think, is of first-rate importance. Man has never been such a fool as our modern astrologists and people who write on magic and so on. They were very reasonable people, and they were just as great geniuses as Mr. Einstein. And I hope I have already shown you that a medicine man in a tribe and a dancer in a tribe is a highly intelligent and passionate person who braves death and can create for eternity. The second step we have to take is to find that the people who build the Maya pyramids in Yucatan or the pyramids in Egypt were just as clever as you are. I think a little cleverer. This megalomania of modern educated men is terrifying. You cannot understand the world as long as you say primitive men. And we, of course, are so enlightened. You are not enlightened. I have never seen so much obscurantism as among you. It is incredible. You believe really that by passing examination you are an educated person. Yesterday a boy came and said, why should I go to war for this country? I want to flee to Canada. It took me 2 hours to convince at least the others who were present that he was an idiot. Any man who cannot stand up and be counted for something that is worth dying is not a man. A woman, and we spoke of this before, but this has to do with our reverence for the great of revelation in the sky, the light of the pyramids. Is visible every evening and every morning all over the globe on a ribbon, you can call it, of perhaps 6 degrees or 10 degrees of latitude. In Flagstaff, Arizona, I have watched it myself from the Lowell Observatory there. Mr. Lowell was good enough to allow me to do that. You can see it everywhere at this latitude. Sometimes it is you can even see it in Richmond. That's a little too far north, however. The Romans and the Greeks could not see it, and that's why they never understood the sorcerers of Egypt, the sorcerer of Pharaoh. In Memphis is the best place on the European African side to observe it, as in Flagstaff here. This pyramidal light is now called officially in science zodiacal light. It was first observed by a European in 1611 of our era, so far too late to influence our judgment on the ancient pharaohs, you see. And the monk who discovered it, it was a monk, called it the zodiacal light because the zodiac moves within this ribbon around the 30th degree in the sky. This does not have to detain us. You only have to know that the Egyptians and the people who have built pyramids all around the globe, in Guatemala, in Yucatan, in Cambodia, had something to go by. They did not fantastically invent a pyramid. A pyramid, after all, is a very abstruse form, a very strange shape. But you are never surprised when I tell you there was a cult of the sun or cult of the moon. This you well understand. But there has never been a cult of the sun. That's one of the idiocy of our modern textbooks. The sun is written in Egypt with this simple sign. And that means day, the day or the sun. This is the sun. Now you can see why it is not very fit for calendar reform, because if something is every day available, you can't make much of it. The sun shines every day. And at least here in California. And for this reason, all the literature you can dump in the waste paper basket, which speaks of a sun cult, has never existed. It's not possible, because on 365 days, the sun is just the same. And you can't do anything. You want to have rules, you want to have order in chronology, you want to have change, and just as the death of the chieftain leads to dances and the sacrifice of the captive, you remember when he gets on the totem pole. If you go over from tribal law to priesthood, the priests want to bring together heaven and earth. The first word of a priestly order is that heaven must be reconciled to earth, heaven must be brought down to earth, something of this order. Men must be sure that the stars in the sky, the horoscope in the sky, is in harmony with what you're doing on earth. A priest is a man who reconciles heaven and earth. You can take this as a good definition. A priest is a man who reconciles heaven and earth, just as a medicine man is somebody who reconciles the ancestors progeny, the younger generation. So the reconciliation in a tribe consists of reconciling you to the life of your ancestors, but in the sky, on earth, the movement in the sky have to be put in harmony with the movement on earth. This is most needed, of course, in agriculture. All agriculture is of priestly origin. For this reason, that's because if you don't know when to sow and when to harvest, you cannot be a farmer. So the first calendar of farming is based on our understanding the laws in the sky, the movements in the sky. But now, let me repeat, it was not the sun that he allowed us to do this, because, as I said, the sun shines every day. You had to find some apparitions, some phenomena that we are not the same every day, by which you could go. As far as we can see, all ancient calendar, before Egypt was founded or before the Aztecs built Mexico City, the ancient law of the calendar was limited to the observation of the full moon and the waxing and waning moon, and to the Pleiades. The Pleiades are a very nice constellation in the sky, and our oldest calendar, as well in Canada as in Bohemia or wherever you go, has been long before the Egyptians organized their country, 6 months periods. In May 1st and November 1st, all what we have today, Pumpkin Day, I mean, what is it?
Halloween.
Halloween. Yes, Halloween, you see, and May 1st, May Day, are probably older than the Egyptian temple calendar, or the Chinese temple calendar for that matter. But they are only observable every 6 months. The constellation of the Pleiades is quite outspoken, explicit, around May 1st and around November 1st. So the people went there, so to speak, in an uncertain fashion. This was not the first May, but around May 1st. It wasn't November 1st, but around November 1st that people went home or went out, you see. The importance of the old pre-Egyptian calendar was that it didn't organize a community for tribal dances or so, but it did allow people to say, this is for outdoor, this is for indoor living. Winter and summer, so to speak, were separated by these two appearances. I mention this to show you that, of course, man always has tried to know, to get orientation, to be led, but it was a very imperfect calendar. The great calendar of Egypt, with which our, as we know, all history of writing in modern ways of script begins, goes back to the year 2778. And the return of this year has been celebrated twice in history, and the result here was that Moses left Egypt in disgust, and the second step was in 139 before the emperors of Rome became Christians. These are the three great events of the so-called great year, Magnus Annus, the return of a period of 1460 years. Now, if you divide 1460, you will find that it is 4 times 365. 4 times 365, that's the same thing as the Olympiad in Greece. Only the Olympiad is 4 years. And this is 4 great years, where every day means 1 year. 365 times 4 is 1460. So through the whole ancient world goes an imitation, and the same is true of the Mexicans and the Chinese. This calendar of Egypt is so important because it has made law all over the globe. And wherever you read today an astrological column of one of these idiots who take your money for nonsense, they base this astrology on the disintegration of the Egyptian calendar. Perhaps there's time enough for me to say something about this disintegration. The astrology of the great empires, of course, meant order for the whole empire, for all people living in one such area. You see the same law applied. Astrology today is as disintegrated as magic, or the magic of a tribal law. Here, if you go to the Hopi or the Navajo Indians, there are some colleagues of mine who devote their time to writing up the law, the magic, the witchcraft of these tribes. It isn't very interesting, because originally the whole tribe, of course, had his songs, their songs, and their bewitchments. But now it is in the hands of some old lady, if she is a lady, and therefore this is disintegrated. The same is true about the calendar today. These astrologers, you see, try to give you a horoscope. But the Egyptian horoscope, of course, was for the whole of Egypt. The same is true about the magic proverbs and verses and songs of a tribe. They were for all Hopis together. And to take them apart and give you some of these enchantments, it makes no sense. We inherit these old traditions in a mutilated form and in a disintegrated form. Nothing applies to the individual, but it is true that 600 BC, you could already travel from Greece to Alexandria or to Cairo or to Memphis and buy a horoscope, you see. Where people are willing to pay something, they always get nonsense. The real things in life are those you cannot pay for. This again seems to be unknown. You believe really that this advertising gives you good things. I don't believe it for a minute. Anything important, you cannot pay for. The idea that everybody has his price is really very sobering up. I mean, don't go communicate with people who have a price. Formerly, they were only found in dishonorable places. But the observation of the sky with regard to the zodiacal light is quite exciting because it allowed men to equate on Earth the movements in the sky. And by this equation, the Lord of Egypt became a sun of the sky. You may have heard that the sun of the sky is an official title of the Emperor of China down to 1911. He was called the sun of the heavens, as it is wrongly translated. We should probably say the sun of the sky. And you find also in the literature sometimes now, rightly so, the application of the term sky world. That is, the skies were treated as a universe with certain rules and regulations, and therefore the Lord of creation had to enter this sky world and take his place among the stars of heaven before you and I were obliged to obey him. The Emperor of China has always claimed that the dictates were not the dictates of his whim or his conscience, but the dictates of the sky, of the heavens. How was this done and why could it be pretended? The situation in Egypt is especially clear. If you look at the map, by and large, it isn't quite literally true, by and large, this is the Nile River streaming north into the Mediterranean. Here would be Cairo and here would be the first pyramids. There are 77 pyramids have been built in the first period between 2078 and 1318. And when this period was finished, Moses left Egypt in disgust. He left Egypt because the return of the great year had shown him that there was nothing behind it. Nothing had happened. So the Old Testament is very closely connected with this astronomical belief of the sorcerers of Pharaoh. Moses is a professor of astrology in Egypt who protests his own doctrine, as all professors should. If you look, can you see it here? This is a very raw, of course, picture, but I think it is better to leave it crude than to try to be give a sharp geographical outline. Because what you have to realize is that the pharaohs of Egypt constitute a lasting chapter of human history, of you and me, without which we cannot do. That's why you have to read the Bible. Pharaoh was an important unit, or important, what's grosser? An important quality. Well, can you say, you can't say he was an important magnitude? Well, Pharaoh was a great man. All right. It is difficult to express this correctly, but we agree on what I try to say, is it? The Nile River goes from south to north. In the whole sky, there is no star that does this. The sun goes from east to west, so does the moon, The stars may move irregularly, but no star moves from south to north. The great discovery of the Nile Valley and the lasting contribution of the pharaohs has been that Pharaoh, as a human being, as an inspired ruler, can do just that. He adds a dimension into the sky world which he alone usurps. He can go from Behedet, as it's called, to Behedet, but in order to make him use a more familiar term, he can go from Aswan, from the first cataract, as the Nile comes down from the mountains, from Ethiopia. He can go from the first cataract to the north, to the mouth of the Delta, the three Delta River, or five Delta arms, and this no god in the sky, no star can. So he is written with two signs for rising in order to show that the Pharaoh is more than a common star. He can do the impossible. The deification of the Pharaoh is quite meaningful and not at all superstitious, because he can, and you can. We can, as we can fight gravity by flying against all the laws of physics at first sight. In the same sense, these people felt that they could fly. Pharaoh flies from, like a falcon, from the south to the north every year when the inundation comes from the sky. There is this very strange weather in Egypt that the Nile rises and rises in July and is at its height in October, at a time when you think there's drought. And then it falls gradually. And in these 3 months, July, August, and September, the fertility of Egypt is to be seen. This magnificent harvest of a valley flooded with the Nile water coming down from the Abyssinian mountains and carrying all the topsoil down the river, you see, and thereby making, fertilizing the valley of the Nile 30 miles east and 30 miles west on a territory not larger than Belgium. So modern Egypt is in fact not larger than the kingdom of Belgium as far as arable, you see, tillable land goes. The rest is desert, left and right. You must understand that Egypt is the most unnatural quantity and most unnatural country in the world to this day. They are, as you may have read in the papers, they are just about to destroy it. Mr. Nasser's vanity is now trying to stop the delivery of the goods, the delivery of this Nile soil, you see, every year, and they dam it up at the Aswan Dam. So if you have shares in the Egyptian economy, sell quickly. Nasser is a great fool. Vanity today destroys the Hindus and the Egyptians. By vanity, great empires can be destroyed. And they act from vanity. And that's very terrible. And in Egypt, it is the destruction of a 3,000-year-old cycle by which every July 19th, the Nile begins to rise, floods the country till October, then the waters recede, and there is a fruitful garden in which the one ear of wheat bears 100-fold and 200-fold. It's the richest corn-producing country in the world for this very reason, that every year it dried out completely, the insects were eliminated, the mice and the rats, because the country dried up in May and June so totally that these animals could not survive. And by this hygienic measure, you see, of the sky world, the fertility that came back with the Nile water in July was just tremendous. It was a most hygienic process, you see. You first dry out the bacteria, and then you invite them back again. Of course, they are very strong and very prosperous. So for 3,000 years, the Nile Valley has been the miracle of mankind. You have seen, perhaps, that the Aswan Dam has just been opened, you see, with the help of of Russian money. We fortunately backed out. This, how did the pharaohs learn that there was this cycle, that the waters would come on July 19th, that all the peasants then had to evacuate the river banks and go on dry land, you see, and then come down again in October when the waters had receded? Well, as you know, the pharaohs built pyramids and invited all their farmers to come during this time from July to October and build bricks. The pyramids have been built with the help of this cycle. Every farmer moved up, or say down the river to Memphis, to Gizeh, to Saqqara, where now the pyramids, the villages stand around which you can find the pyramids. And Pharaoh had to establish great, barns to supply them, to feed them. It's the first organization of state provision for his people, you see, so that they could work on public works. So the Job Corps of today is just nothing compared to what they did. An Egyptian peasant is a man who is 2 or 3 months in the service of the central government, is fed by him from the corn chambers. You find it all in the Old Testament, of course, in the book of Moses, and who for the other 9 months has his own garden, his own field, his own land, his own fishing supply, and is a happy creature, utterly undaunted by the future, because he has a guaranteed income as no vice president in a bank in America has. For the purpose of predicting this with security, the pharaohs, one pharaoh, the first pharaoh we must assume, we don't know, but it must have been around 2000, as I said, in this year, that is in the third millennium of our era, they set aside priests. A priest is a man who is observant of the sky in antiquity. Observing is quite a good word instead of serving. It is both. You serve and you observe. The two words have something to do with each other. To be an observant of the sky is perhaps better than to be a serf of a master. But it is the same devotion to duty. The Egyptians are the first who invented a lifetime job. A priest was a man who worked in a chain gang, in shifts. The sky had to be observed permanently. The new invention of the Egyptians has been the permanency of function. Now the individual, you and I, we cannot do anything permanent. We have to sleep, we have to eat, we have to retire, we have to joke, we have to make love. Therefore, the individual human being is misfit for observing natural processes. You cannot do this, and I cannot do this. You can only do this if you organize the priests of Egypt in a gang, who every 8 hours take turns, or every 12 hours, however, whatever you want to do. And this is the great creation of Egypt, observation. And for this purpose, they said, all of Egypt is one big family, it's one great house, and in this house, the children of the house, the priests, take turns. They all belong. Everybody is provided for. Nobody has to go starve. But everybody has to be available at his hour. If you compare this with a tribal hunter or a tribal warrior, you see distinction. In a tribe, there is no such permanency, you see. People go to sleep, they run away, they migrate, they sleep. The new order of the universe is one of permanent or perpetual observation. Without observation, no empire. And I lay great stress on this tiny word observation, because if you observe the word observe, you see that service is entailed in knowledge. It is not true that an astronomer doesn't have to serve the sky because he can know the sky. It's unfortunate that the Lick Observatory seems not to no longer to be open. Who has been there? That's too few. Because some shudder of reverence would overtake you, perhaps, if you would see that people have learned about the sky only by permanent observation, by this service to the this reverence to the quiet movement of the stars. It is not, you cannot become an astronomer as you can become a grammar school teacher. Something of the veneration of the eternal, of the ever, of the always, must enter your hide. It doesn't with most people. Most people today are enlightened, brazen, and insolent with regard to their profession. They think they are masters of their profession. An Egyptian wouldn't have understood this. He would have only understand that you had the privilege of observing the stars. It's a very good term because it means that in the observance there is respect, there is service, and there is availability for all the needs of the sky and in the sky. And nobody should have a vocation without such a vocation. And most of you think that if they are paid $10 a day, they must take the job. Don't do it. Neither the $10 will be a blessing nor the job. If it isn't as a doctor who says, because people are sick, I must be available at midnight, he's not a doctor. If he does it as do unfortunately people in this country do now, because it's a well-paid job and very honorable and you get a better wife this way, that is with more money, don't do it. It's not a good reason to becoming a doctor. All our observances can only prosper and can only be meaningful if you are willing to recognize that you're serving some higher authority. Now the sky, for the Egyptians, of course, and for the people in Yucatan, where I have also observed the pyramids, of course they knew that the service came first, and they knew it from the simple fact that the observation of the star lore cannot be omitted any hour. Therefore, from the very first beginning, people have to link up, many of them, you see, to establish one such core of observation, of observers. Priesthood, therefore, is the first discovery of a permanent office, because you were only a priest if you had somebody who took over when you went to bed. It is still true of the 12 of the Horai in a monastery, in a Catholic monastery, that the prayers go on unbrokenly, you see, and that guarantees the observance. And you don't know this, you think if you have a 5-hour week, that's progress. I think it's regress. Because you are left out in the cold with something you can do or you cannot do. It's most unfortunate for a human being. We only are honored if you have to do certain things. Now the Egyptians, of course, practiced this. From the very first, they sat on the roof of high buildings people who had to observe 24 hours a day. So they invented the shift. They invented this belonging to a core of professional men. All the professions go back to empires like Egypt. Star lore is the first professionalism in the world, because it prescribes its own day to your and my need, you see. We want to sleep and we want to eat. The stars are there all the time, sun and moon and stars. The starting point of these observations we can trace to July 19th, 2778. Why? The observation made at that time was that you could see the brightest star in the sky of the night, which is your, does anybody know which star that is? You all should know. Which is the brightest? What? Of course, Sirius. Sirius is, it is, he's minus 60. That is, when all the other stars you see rank beyond zero, You have to reach him in quite a different numeral and quite a different catalog. Sirius excelled all the other stars of the night. Now it was found, and we can say in which year, that Sirius was visible at sunrise in the year 2778 on July 19th. This seemed a miracle. The brightest star in the night and the bright star of the morning, you see, in conjunction. That seemed to be a good starting point for the new calendar. If you have the union of these two majestic lights in the sky, perhaps then the order would evolve. And it is, we have to assume that with a great rejoicing, this was found. I have my ideas even by whom, but that is neither here nor there. I cannot prove this. That on July 19th, 2778, the minister of His Majesty, the Horos, said, "Your Majesty, we have it. Eureka. We have the unity of heaven and at night and heaven at day. And therefore, from now on, Your Majesty will sign all documents with the sign of double rising." That's how it's written. This in Egyptian hieroglyphs means to rise. And or any pharaoh is written with a double sign, two caps in his feather, or two feathers in his cap. The double crown of Egypt is based on the assumption that the emperor of Egypt has made it possible to know the sky at day and at night, so until they harmonize. But more, I told you already that the emperor of Egypt is the only human being or the only living being who can go do what the stars cannot do. He can go in the one direction in which no star moves, from south to north. And that's here where the historical significance of Egypt is best founded. Since the Nile River moves from south to north, and no star does this, they all move east-west, you see, the pharaoh claimed divinity because he could add a movement which the stars could not show themselves or perform themselves. We find that Horus is the god of Egypt, the pharaoh, because every year on July 19th, he has to embark in the south of Egypt at Luxor and at Aswan and travel in great hurry down the Nile River to the north, performing this one movement of which he could boast that this made him the equal of the gods in the sky, because he did what they couldn't do. That's why he was written with a double sign. He was more than them. And you must understand that it's quite important for you, even though you are allegedly Republicans or Democrats, to understand monarchy, to understand kingship, to understand empires. The worship of the empire, as you find it in Troilus and Cressida, and you read there the great speech of the Odysseus on order, all goes back to this great event of humanity, that men can do more than the silent universe can do. We can add those movements which in the universe are not performed. We have this divine liberty of doing something no star, no animal, nobody can. We can go uphill. Man is the uphill animal of creation. I printed 40 years ago. I'm still quite proud of this sentence. Perhaps you take that down. Man is the uphill animal of creation. Unfortunately, you learn in physics that it is natural to follow the trend. For men, it is unnatural to follow the trend. You are men in so far as you do not follow the trend, because then we are in our proper nature. Man was created, obviously, on earth, as they say, as a deficient being, not imitating one of the trends of nature, but going against them all. And if you do not stop calling yourself a natural being, you will all be wiped out. Mice are wiped out, fleas are wiped out, because they are so terribly natural. And we are unnatural, supernatural, whatever you call. But we can go against the trend. And there man begins. Anybody who follows the trend, dismiss him. And interesting. Don't marry him. Because it's a trend to have several wives. This is a pest, an epidemic in this country, that is called a recommendation if you say this is natural. It's a warning. You cannot live naturally. Down with it. Down with the beard. Now the Egyptians knew this, and that the Horus, the emperor of Egypt, could go from south to north, distinguished him, made him the ruler of this east, as they were called, the two lands, the north and the south, were united by him. The title of the pharaoh is Uniter of the Two Countries, meaning this narrow valley here and the delta out here. For the same reason, the calendar of the Egyptian is still pertinent to us. They divided the year in 360 plus five days. 12 months they had, 10 months they had, 36 days each. That's older than our calendar with its unbelievable, you see, February. What is this? What kind of calendar is this? Well, the February has 28 days. They didn't have this mischief-making month. They counted 10 times 36 days, and the Romans, the Latins did the same, down to 500.